Well, I don't know about you, but Preston and I still have a little turkey left over in our fridge. And I think that means that there's time for one more pilgrim story. So when the pilgrims landed in North America, they held their communities together not by the rule of law, but by covenant. They pledged to walk together in truth. Now, these factions, two factions later emerged out of the pilgrim group, one liberal and one conservative, and the liberal branch split off into what eventually became the Unitarians. And we still pledge to walk together in truth. Walk together in truth. It's a really beautiful phrase. What does it mean? What is truth? There's a Chinese proverb that says there are three truths. There's my truth, your truth, and the truth. It's actually not my favorite saying, so I've changed it. I say there are three truths. There is scientific truth. There is eternal truth. And there is personal truth. The 18th and 19th centuries brought science into almost every facet of life. And it became generally accepted then that everything real could be substantiated by mathematics. Even the clergy got into this act, and they used science to prove that the Bible stories were real. They would conduct elaborate experiments and research, measuring the bellies of whales to see if Jonah really could have been swallowed by one. And they used astronomy to pinpoint the exact location of the Star of Bethlehem on the night that Jesus was born. Now, scientists quickly moved on, and their disciplined use of the scientific method actually brought them to the fact that any mathematical system will always be incomplete. And even though today scientists still strive to find a truth that will endure as long as possible, they know that even the most solid truths are provisional and tentative. Certainly, science makes no claims on absolute or final truth. The world's religions, on the other hand, do recognize eternal truth about things that are beyond the physical, time-bound world in which we live. They all seem to claim to have the one eternal truth, yet they're all saying different things. Having a debate about which one is more valid than the other seems to me to have that quality of how many angels can dance on the head of a pin? You know, that question. I think it confuses more than it clarifies. And it doesn't get to the stuff of our lives. In 1833, a man sat in a Unitarian church listening to a particularly long and tedious sermon. Having lost interest in the preacher's message, the man gazed out the window at the snowstorm. And as he watched the world outside, he realized that there was more truth in the snowfall than what the preacher was saying. There was more life in the laughter of human experience than there could be in those ancient Bible stories. That was the real truth out there. Now, that man sitting in the back of the church that day was Ralph Waldo Emerson, the Oracle of Concord. Later, he would tell this story to graduating students at Harvard Divinity School. He urged them to use their powers of reason, critical thought, and their own intuition to find truth, not only in the Bible, but in their own lives, in their experiences of the holy, and in the stuff of their lives. The stuff of our lives, that is the third type of truth, personal truth. Like eternal truth, it cannot be and need not be proved. There is no math involved, thank goodness, no logic that can be applied. Unlike eternal truth, it is experiential and subjective. Personal truth resonates with things that are inside all of us. Call it soul, divine spark, or deep self. We live out of these personal truths, and it impacts the way we interact with our families and our coworkers. It shapes the way we care for our bodies and care for this earth. We live out of our personal truths, both consciously and unconsciously. As most of you know, one of our seven principles is the free and responsible search for truth and meaning. And although this search can take us into a scientific or a political search for truth, I believe this principle is there mainly to uphold the value of a spiritual search, a search for experiential truth, personal truth. Now, like the pilgrims, we in this community have covenanted to walk together in the search for truth. I've been watching the way we carry out this search for truth, and I've noticed two things. First, sometimes we act as if the search is more important than arriving at the truth. A famous seagull once said, "It is good to be a seeker, but sooner or later you have to be a finder." Why are we so quick to seek, yet so wary to find? Well, I think if we could see that arriving at the truth is not permanent and absolute, then, like Maya Angelou says, we can finally get to it. We can finally come to it. We seek truth, and when we find it, we find a new self as well. And with this new truth, we can embark on yet another search and again arrive anew. Actually, arriving somewhere doesn't mean that it's the end of all of our searching. I think T.S. Eliot's observation here about the truth-seeking journey is most resonant. He said, "The end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time." This exploration brings us to encounter all kinds of people, and they are crucial to our search. Seeking after truth is not something that we do alone. And that's the other thing that I've noticed about the seeking, is that we tend to approach it as if this is something that we do all by ourselves. Seeking after truth is not something we do alone. And that's one of the reasons I don't care for that Chinese proverb of three truths, my truth, your truth, the truth. It just makes it sound so separate. Like, I have mine, you have yours, and they will not meet and they will not interact. One of my colleagues delivered a sermon on truth this summer where she said, "I do not need to hold your truth, only my truth. And you do not need to know or accept mine." It sounds like a pretty cold world to me. So why do we want to hold on to that idea that we don't need each other to find truth? Well, I think it's because we're used to thinking that when two truths about the same subject are put together, there's a collision and only one survives. That's the scientific, that's the rational, mechanistic way of thinking about things. And that's really fine when we're talking about science, because we really need to get to the truth. But so, for example, if we all tried to estimate how far it is from the piano to the pulpit, and you all took a guess, then there would only be one right answer, and the others would be false. The others would be killed off. And that's okay, because there's really not that much at stake, right? But when we're talking about personal truth or experiential truth or, you know, my truth, no one wants his or her truth to be killed off. So we'd rather just keep the other truth at a distance, at a very safe distance. So I can keep mine, you can keep yours, and we'll avoid engaging each other about the differences. But when we keep others at a distance like that, we miss so much. Columbia University professor Patricia Williams tells this childhood story about riding in the back seat of their Studebaker with the family on a summer vacation going up to Maine. She and her sister are sitting in the back seat, and they're arguing about the color of the highway. Patricia says, "It's black," and her sister says, "It's purple." Well, Patricia's older, and so she harangues her sister into admitting that, okay, the road is black. Overhearing this, their father points out that the younger sister, no matter what she says, still saw and still had the experience of the road as purple. Now, years later, Patricia started to look at the highways during the hot summer months and decided that they actually do look a little more purple than black. And she learned that it is possible to experience things, even very concrete things, simultaneously yet differently. And that seeing simultaneously yet differently is more easily done by two people than one. The spiritual search for truth is personal, but it is not individualistic. It is not an individual quest. It is relational. And it must be so, because as the Reverend Mark Morrison Reed reminds us, alone our vision is too narrow to see all that must be seen, and our strength too limited to do all that must be done. We need other people. We need other people to hear our self-revelation, and we need to hear and be changed by theirs. When we allow this to happen, the truth that we arrive at is bigger and is greater than any one that we could have imagined finding for our own. This is especially true when we engage intimately with people who are very different from us. When we encounter people who challenge our old ways of being, we can either take the, you tell you your truth, I'll tell my truth, and we'll let the difference kind of lay there approach, or we can truly be open to new revelations and dive right into the difference. But this does not have to result in one truth getting killed off. When we realize that both truths are valid, not only valid, but that each feeds the other and makes it grow. Truth gets more expansive, not simply by adding your truth to someone else's truth. It gets larger because this type of encounter with the other will move you to connect with your deep self and arrive at a new personal truth that emerges as greater than anything you could have imagined by yourself. In 1993, David Christensen, a white man in his 50s, agreed to participate in a weekend-long retreat to engage in a dialogue about race. This retreat would be later filmed and made into a documentary called The Color of Fear. David was there with seven other men. Two of those men were African American, two Latino Americans, two Asian Americans, and there was one other Euro-American white male. The retreat took place in David's hometown of Ukiah, a small rural community in Northern California. Now, as they gathered there on Friday evening, waiting for everyone to arrive, Victor, one of the African American men, came into the house commenting how relieved he was to have made it before nightfall. The others nodded knowingly. But David didn't know what he was talking about. Even after Victor and the others explained how a person of color is held suspect when driving at night in a rural town, David would not accept it. After all, this was his home. He knew all the people there. They were good people. He knew the police officers, and he knew them to be fair, upstanding people. Racism may exist in other places, he thought, but racism does not exist in Ukiah. Besides, he said, people of color take racism way too seriously. They should simply stand on their own ground, as white people do. David is as good of a man as there can be. He believes in justice and fairness, and he agreed to spend 3 days at a retreat talking about racism. But he could not, or would not, release his grip on his truth. He had made his truth absolute. In fact, he had organized his entire life around that truth, and there was no room for a conflicting truth. Too much was at stake. His whole identity as a good person was at stake. The collision of these two truths would last the entire weekend. People yelled and cried and fell silent, but no one left. By the end of the weekend, David was able to say with sincerity and honesty, "I can't feel what Victor feels, but I think I've got a piece of it now. I appreciate that I was here. It will have an impact on me for the rest of my life." How did that happen? How did David come to making such a huge turn in just a few short days? Did David just concede? Or did Victor win the debate by simply presenting more and better evidence? No, it didn't have anything to do with finding a logical, empirical resolution. This group of eight men had intentionally created an environment in which the diverse and often opposing personal truths could be told. It was an atmosphere in which someone could both speak and listen in ways that would alter his experience of what was true. That small group of men created a dynamic that allowed for the unfolding of a greater transcendent truth, and together they arrived at a shared experience of wound and an understanding of how wound prevents them from truly engaging with people who are different. So, after 3 days in such a climate, David became aware of an old memory, a painful personal truth. "This will probably be difficult for me," he said, "but so that you understand, I was raised by a father who was very much opinionated and a racist, I would say. My father would tell jokes about blacks that would put them down, and he implanted in me an understanding that they are undesirable people. And if I ever disagreed with him, he would beat me. I learned to do what he said just to protect myself from abuse. David's early wounding had created a wall that didn't allow the experiences of people of color to get in. David created this wall because as a youngster, when he tried to explain those experiences to his father, he was beaten. That weekend in Ukiah, surrounded by a circle of compassionate companions, David was finally able to connect with his deep self, to retrieve and then speak a new truth. What brave and startling truth is waiting for you in your deep self? And who will take your hand on that downward, inward journey to find it? May we renew our pledge to walk in truth. Amen.